This is Phil Farron.
And I am driving home.
It's Thursday today.
This Thursday is a little different. I'm actually leaving from my major client and I'm driving home. For what, the last plans? 6-7 months? Actually, maybe more than that. Because I've been swinging by to see Pop for some time now. But not this week. As I mentioned last week, my dad did pass on the 20th. He went very peacefully, quickly. This last week has been busy. But good. Got it done. That's the important thing. Got it done. So, you know, I've been making funeral arrangements. Got figured out when we were going to have the funeral. My brother came in, finished up funeral arrangements on Saturday, Sunday, you know, figured out all the stuff, figured out what I wanted to say, went to work on Monday, picked up my brother from the airport at 11 o'clock at night, Monday night. By the time we got him back to the house and we gapped and chatted for a while, it was 1 a.m. when we finally headed to bed. And then I fell asleep fairly quickly because I'm, you know, used to that. But he'd been traveling, and so he didn't, he said he didn't get to sleep till about 3 a.m. our time. And then we were back up, and I was back to the funeral home at 8 o'clock, 8:15-ish, Tuesday morning. And Lizzie had come in as well, and so we were setting up all the stuff, and we had everything ready to go about 15 minutes ahead of time, and then people started kind of wandering in, and we were chatting and doing that whole thing. Had a nice turnout. We had about 40 people come, which, actually, 35-ish, which, you know, that's kind of what I was expecting. Dad has been out of circulation for long enough now that, you know, some people came just for me, and some people came to see Wink, and some people came from the church, and so it was nice. It was very nice. We had a lovely funeral. You know, we had lots of laughing, a few tears here and there. Lizzie played the accordion. We sang Mr. Dunderbeck. All is well. I did leave out a section. Oh, I left out a section in my talk for the funeral. You know, I just kind of, I got down and I started into my closing stuff. And then I was like, oh, wait a minute. And then I thought, it's fine. And I just went on and just closed it up, and that was that. But I was talking to my daughter later, and she said, no one knew. Okay, good. So it didn't sound too disjointed. But we got that done. Said our goodbyes. So we're good. We're good. Everything's been paid for. Now I just have to have a little final cleanup stuff, trying to figure out exactly what happened. I thought I had everything in place financially and everything was good. And as it turns out, I'm a joint owner. I don't know if I mentioned this last week, but I'm a joint owner. Can't remember if I mentioned this. Joint owner on their checking account, and that means I may need to treat the money that's in the checking account as a gift to me. And if that's the case, I don't think there's any gift tax to me, but then as I turn around, I gotta get to with an elder law person just to make sure. Once we get that done, we'll get the money split up. Got to find out what's going on with that $30,000 check. You know, my attitude is, well, it is what it is, but I'm going to call tomorrow and see, because there are others who are interested to know whether or not we've got an extra $30,000 coming in. So that's fine. That's understandable. That's understandable. Obviously, needless to say, I didn't get as much done this week on the editing of the book 9 as I wanted, so that's thrown me several days late. But I mean, honestly, this is the funeral, and the disruptions came about in as good a spot as it could possibly come. So, and no matter what spot the interruption would have come in, you know, you just deal with it. You say, okay, well, this is what we need to do now. So I'm expecting this weekend to get some good work in on it, the book, and hopefully by the end of this weekend I'll be ready to start my read-through. Read-through will take about a week. Once I get the read-through done, then I can just relay everything out, get all of the files built for the production version, get them all uploaded, then order some review copies, and get them in sometime around the first of the year. We'll call book 9 done. I don't know if I mentioned, but I redid my chart. I've had this kind of scribbled chart up on my whiteboards at home of where I'm at and what needs to be done where on the books for, you know, the next 14 books. Once I get book 9 done. 15 books. Once I get book 9 done. Oh, this is crazy. And so I have all the months in a grid and what happens during each month, you know, with labeled with the legends and stuff, and I'm Xing through those. So I'm periodically going to start taking pictures of that and just posting that on Facebook, so I got a little bit of a record.
Excuse me. Oh, boy.
Long week. So I'm expecting to take a picture of that every time I put out a production version. So, you know, there'll be a picture for book 9, and then there'll be 15 more books. So, yeah. So there'll be 16 pictures. There you go. Anyway, so that all seems to be going fine. General reactions to book 9 have been good, so that's all fine. You know, it's good. It's good. Looking forward to getting back and working on book 10, because there's going to be some fun stuff in it, and it may be a little more humorous than the other books. So, you know, it certainly starts out a little more humorous than the other books. But it'll be good. And then, dun-dun-dun, book 11, dun-dun-dun. So anyways, all is well. All is well. You know, it's good. It's really good to have hope. You know, to live in such a way. I was out with a friend. Oh, that's what I did. So we were back, we had the funeral, so then after the funeral, I went and grabbed some food from Bob Evans, and then the family went back to Nana's house, and we had a meal together, and we chatted for a while, and then, brought my brother back to the house. We figured out what of the little paraphernalia there he wanted, which I've got to go home tonight, pack up some boxes to mail to them. And then I took him back out at the airport, so had him out to the airport about 3:45, chatted with him a little bit. He was ready to go inside around 4, because he was going to be boarding in a few minutes, so gave him a hug, let him go. Then I went from there back to headquarters, picked up a friend, we went out to dinner. So that was a long day, but it was a good day. It was a good day. My buddy that I went out to dinner with on Tuesday, you know, he commented on the fact that I seemed to be at peace, and I told him I am at peace. I am. It was good. You know, I'll see Pop again. It's great. So yeah, but you know, there's been plenty to keep me busy this week, and so we'll just keep puttering forward and adjusting to the new normal now, since I don't need to swing by Maranatha anymore, and I don't need to be super sensitive to, that's the other thing I've got to do. I've got to go have his phone get disconnected. Got to do that. Put that on my list. Got to call AT&T tomorrow. List of people to call. I have several people I've got to call tomorrow to kind of finish things up and close things down and yada yada. So, but we'll get that all done tomorrow, and hopefully get some editing done tomorrow as well, and then we'll go forward. This week, I had heard of this story, and I think I mentioned it, and that I was probably going to do something on it. This is really interesting. This whole identity politics, equity, social justice warrior stuff, it's just so interesting. And it's, to me, it's going to be so interesting to see just how far this can go. Because it's so fascinating to see us come so far in terms of scientific investigation and clear thinking and, you know, reasonability and logic and that sort of thing, and then just roaring up out of this. Got this postmodernism stuff, although certainly the seeds have been laid for postmodernism decades ago. And certainly Nietzsche saw what was coming. With, as soon as people say God is dead and everything becomes relative, I mean, that really, if everything is relative, it stabs to the heart of any kind of scientific investigation. And then with the rise of deconstructionism and neo-Marxism, postmodernism, all that kind of stuff, it's really fascinating to see all this stuff come about. And as part of a kind of a reaction to that, I came across this article of some people that reproduced what has been called the SoCal experiment, because this happened in the late 1990s, and you know, it seemed to be a fairly infamous thing, and it should have been something that would have made everybody sit up and take notice and say, wait a minute, let's think our way through this. But apparently we didn't pay too much attention, so we had to have someone else try it. The name of this article is What an Audacious Hoax Reveals About Academia. So, basically, three scholars decide that they were going to reproduce the SoCal experiment, which we'll talk about in a minute, and they wrote 20 fake papers using fashionable jargon to argue for ridiculous conclusions. So, over the past 12 months, this article was put out on October 5th, 2008, and I think I mentioned that this had happened, and I'd do a podcast on it at some point. So, like, over the past year, there were three scholars, James Lindsay, Helen Pluckrose, and Peter Boghossian, I think. They wrote 20 fake papers using fashionable jargon to argue for ridiculous conclusions, and they tried to get them placed in high-profile journals in the fields including gender studies, queer studies, and fat studies. Their success rate was remarkable. By the time they took their experiment public, 7 of their articles had been accepted for publication by ostensibly serious peer-reviewed journals. 7 more were still going through various stages of the review process, and only 6 had been rejected. And so, it's very similar to what Alan Sokol, a professor of physics at New York University, began a soon-to-be infamous article by setting out some of his core beliefs. So this is what he said in the late 1990s. Quote, "There exists an external world whose properties are independent of any individual human being, and indeed humanity as a whole. These properties are encoded in, quote, eternal, quote, physical laws, and that human beings can obtain reliable, albeit imperfect and tentative knowledge of these laws by hewing to the objective procedures and epistemological structures proscribed by the so-called scientific method." Unquote. So Sokol went on to disprove his credo in fashionable jargon. Quote, "Feminist and post-structuralist critiques have demystified the substantive content of mainstream Western scientific practice, revealing the ideology of domination concealed behind the facade of objectivity. It has thus become increasingly apparent that physical reality, no less than social reality, is at bottom a social and linguistic construct." So, in other words, he's saying, he was reacting to the same thing that a lot of us are reacting to today. That things like, well, gender is just a social construct. Wait a minute, whoa, you know, and that everything is just all about power, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he writes this paper, it's got all this just jargon in it, trying to prove that reality, what we see, it's all just stuff that we make up, and that's what we experience, that there's no reality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Sokol, in the late 1990s, sends this off to Social Text, which is an academic journal that was, at the time, a leading forum for famous scholars, and it was published. So in the eyes of his supporters, what became known as the Sokol hoax seemed to prove the most damning charges that critics of postmodernism had long leveled against it. Postmodernism discourse is so meaningless, they claimed, that not even experts can distinguish between people who make sincere claims and those who compose deliberate gibberish. Okay, in the months after Sokol went public, the journal Social Text was much ridiculed, but its influence, that of the larger deconstructivist mode of inquiry it propagated, continued to grow. Still going. Indeed, many academic departments that devote themselves to the study of particular ethnic, religious, and sexual groups are deeply inflected by some of Social Text's core beliefs, including radical subjectivity of knowledge. Now, those code words, radical subjectivity of knowledge, that means that there are no facts. And for the most part, facts are simply the tools of the oppressor to keep the oppressed under heel. Facts are simply the way that the oppressors bludgeoned the oppressed to make them think that their life experience is not valid. So anytime that you're dealing with someone who believes that they are part of the oppressed class and that everything exists simply to keep them oppressed, there's no point in trying to quote statistics, no point in trying to quote any quote-unquote facts to them, because their response will be All that stuff was just made up to keep the oppressed under heel. That there really is no such thing as an objective fact. Just a moment, I'm getting my mail. Which, of course, undermines all of scientific investigation. So that makes for sort of an interesting... Let's see. Okay. I'm going to have to call. Yes, I'm going to have to call and see if we're supposed to get this check. Because we just got another check from the government for another $3,000. But the question is, are we really supposed to have that check? So I'm going to have to call tomorrow and figure out. Because that's for Dad's VA stuff. And I certainly don't want to give something away and then have them come back and say, wait a minute, he's dead. You owe us that check back. So things to do. Anyway, so since there didn't seem to be much progress being made on the fact that Sokol pointed out that stuff that was just gibberish was indistinguishable from stuff that was published in these journals, then you had these three researchers decide they would try this again. See if they could make a dent in anything, which I don't think they will. Which is really interesting. It's just really interesting. So, in this article, they say, okay, that's why Lindsay Pluckrose and Boghossian set out to rerun the original hoax, only on a much larger scale, call it Sokol Squared. Generally speaking, the journals that fell for Sokol Squared publish respected scholars from respected programs. For example, Gender, Place, and Culture, which accepted one of the hoax papers, has in the past months published work from professors at UCLA, Temple, Penn State, Trinity College, Dublin, the University of Manchester, and Berlin's Humboldt University, among any others. The sheer craziness of the papers the authors concocted makes this fact all the more shocking. One of their papers reads like a straight riff of Sokol Host, dismissing, quote, Western astronomy as sexist and imperialist. It makes a case for physics departments to study feminist astrology or practice interpretive dance instead. So here we go. This is from the paper. Other means superior to the natural sciences exist to extract alternative knowledges about stars and enriching astronomy, including ethnography and other social science methodologies, careful examination of the intersection of extant astrologies from around the globe, incorporation of mythological narratives and modern feminist analysis of them, feminist interpretive dance, especially with regard to the movement of stars and their astrological significance, and direct application of feminist and post-colonial discourses concerning alternative knowledges and cultural narratives. In other words, these guys in their paper said all this stuff, in essence, all this stuff with telescopes and all this stuff with, you know, Hubble and all this stuff with trying to figure out what planets are around what stars by examining the dimming characteristics of the lights that's received. You know, all that stuff is fine and dandy, but really it's just sexist and imperialist because it's all built on Enlightenment values. So instead of doing that, what we should really do, we should turn to how people feel about astrology and the astrologist and have them just write about what they think is out there in the heavens. And that's just as good a way to figure out what's in the heavens as all these telescopes and all that kind of stuff. And even better, if there are feminists who do interpretive dance to astrology, we should be open-minded enough that we could take their interpreted dances and build our knowledge about the heavens on them. The paper that was published... Okay, so that's one of the things. The paper that was published in Gender, Place, and Culture seems downright silly. So this one was Human Reaction to Rape Culture and Queer Performity at Urban Dog Parks in Portland, Oregon. And it claims to be based on an in-situ observation of canine rape culture in a Portland dog park. Quote, do dogs suffer oppression based on perceived gender, unquote, the paper asks. I'm not going to read the next one because it's, it doesn't embarrass me, but it's just, I'd have to issue trigger warnings. So the article goes on to say, Sokol Squared doesn't just expose the low standards of the journals that publish this kind of dreck. It also demonstrates the extent to which many of them are willing to license discrimination if it serves ostensibly progressive goals. See, I mean, and this is what it gets down to. Okay, if this type of drivel was being written against something like, the social justice warriors or that sort of thing, making a claim against them, then everybody would pull out the stops and say how unscientific it was and blah, 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 blah. But the fact that it's being written against what is considered the oppressive white hierarchy, i.e. science, then it gets a ready ear. They said this tendency becomes most evident in an article that advocates extreme measures to redress the privilege of white students, exhorting college professors to enact forms of experiential reparation. The paper suggests telling privileged students to stay silent or even binding them to the floor in chains. If students protest, educators are told to take considerable care not to validate privilege, emphasize with, or reinforce it, and in doing so, recenter the needs of privileged groups at the expense of marginalized ones. The reactionary verbal protestations of those who oppose the progressive stack are verbal behaviors and defensive mechanisms that mask the fragility inherent to those inculcated in privilege. Bad. So anyways, of course, part of the problem is that people don't just take this for what it is and say, okay, there's a problem here, here, and here, So of course, the conservatives say this just proves that all journals are corrupt. Well, of course, that's not true. Because as the article said, there are fields of academia that have absolutely no patience for nonsense. Said, while the hoaxers did manage to place article in some of the most influential academic journals that cluster of fields that focus on issues of race, gender, and identity, they have not penetrated the leading journals in more traditional disciplines. As a number of academics pointed out on Twitter, for example, all of the papers submitted to sociology journals were rejected. Out of hand. Okay. The article also goes on to say, by the same token, many leftists are willing to grasp at straws to defend the journals and fields of inquiry that they regard as morally righteous. Some have dismissed Sokol Squared by pointing out that many disciplines, from economics to psychology, have also in the past faced crisis of confidence. Others have simply cited the conservative instrumentation of Sokol Squared as a reason to ignore it. Academics, Allison Phipps wrote on Twitter, please stand by my colleagues in gender studies, critical race studies, fat studies, and other areas target. This is a coordinated attack from the right. But, the only problem is that the authors describe themselves as left-leaning liberals. And the article says, for another, it's nonsensical to insist that nonsense scholarship doesn't matter because you don't like the motives of the people who expose it, or because some of the forms of scholarship may also contain nonsense. If certain fields of study cannot reliably differentiate between real scholarship and noxious bloviating, they become suspect. You know, so what are we to do here? This is such an interesting time to be alive. And I would be remiss if I didn't try a little Jesus smuggling at this point to use the term that Eric Weinstein gave us. About how when you're talking to these Christian people, you know, you get down to something that's not understandable, and then all of a sudden they smuggle in Jesus. So I would be remiss if I didn't try a little Jesus smuggling here, but the fact of the matter is, I don't think you could have had an enlightenment without a deep feeling that the universe made sense. Because you look at all those early scientists, and they all believed. They believed that there was a unifying principle in the universe. They believed that there were secrets out there that made sense, and they could go find them. If there's just chaos in the heavens, and there's no guarantee that what you discover as a rule today is going to be a rule tomorrow, if... you know, then why even bother to do all the investigation? You know, so we have had this tremendous scientific foundation that I don't think could have ever gotten started unless you believed in some sort of master designer. And then the sensibility and the permanence of the heavens. And that then has led us to all of these amazing discoveries. And those amazing discoveries have led us to this tremendous explosion of scientific knowledge and all the technologies that has given birth to and has brought us. Science has been fantastically successful. But then we decided we were a little too big for our britches. And then we decided, well, you know, we don't really need God. So let's just kill off God. And let's say that with quantum mechanics, we don't really know that there's, you know, what's going on. There's chaos in the heavens. But we're going to keep going. Pretending like there's things that make sense, even though we don't have any idea how they're supposed to make sense. And I think out of all this moral relativism, out of this, well, there is no objective truth. Everybody has their own subjective truth. This all just is cascading down to where, you know, you got like the flat earth movement. It's like, but beyond the flat earth movement, you have this neo-Marxist deconstructionist stuff where we just decide how we're just going to redefine everything because everything's relative. So it's really, you know, we are at this point in this intellectual dysfunctionality where we have the whole segment of our population over there that have reduced everything to terms of power. It's that there's no, all that words and all that science is for was just to establish power to oppress people, which just, wow. Wow, this is going to be fascinating to see where this goes. Unless we just think that this is a bunch of crackpots, that we're never going to have to worry about them. All you have to do is look at places like Canada where you see these gender studies and you see all of this LGBTQ stuff and you see all of these pronouns now. And I just watched a seminar where they were saying, yeah, in some places in Canada that the children 5 years old are not allowed to use pronouns anymore. They just have to refer to person because it's just too complicated. Or there's other places where when you're in college, you know, you have a name tag, and on your name tag you put your name, and then you have to put the pronouns that you like to be known by so everybody can call you by the right pronouns. Because everything's fluid, because you can be anything you want, because, you know, there's not really any such thing as gender anymore because, well, you know, supposedly scientists have said this, but that they're just using this as a way to oppress us. So it's going to be really interesting to watch the tension between the scientists, who frankly have been very successful at what they're doing, and all these, you know, the gender feminist, fat racial studies and all those kind of things. It's going to be really interesting because all of those kind of studies usually try to play on the empathy of people. And so you get into things where you have, and I may do a podcast on this, you have a physicist who got tired of all this, who got passed over for a job and inappropriately named the fact he had gotten passed over in a paper. But he put together this presentation with all these statistics and all these graphs showing that contrary to women physicists being held to a higher standard when it came to getting hired, they were in fact held to a much lower standard. And he showed this statistically, and then he made the mistake of mentioning his own experience. And for simply pointing this stuff out, he got fired from his job. They're like thousands of scientists that are signing up and saying, oh, this was terrible of him to do this. So these scientists who believe in science are now saying, well, you can't point out that women are being held to a lower standard. That's a terrible thing to do. I mean, so it influences, whether we want it to influence or not, it influences because no one wants to be seen as racist or a misogynist or this or that. Everyone's afraid. This is the nice thing about not being famous, because I don't care. It's really fascinating. This is going to be a really fascinating thing to see where it lands. Because if we actually adopt a stance that all facts are relative, that all science is relative, and if we go so far somehow to get to the place where we believe that interpretive dance, that feminist interpretive dance of astrological signs is just as good as telescopes. Oh, it's going to be an interesting, interesting world. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.